So yesterday we talked about one set of approaches to generative modeling, which were the explicit likelihood measure techniques, where optimization is done over really trying to be able to calculate something about the probability density of these distributions. And today we're going to focus on two ways of sort of approaching that without approaching it, because sometimes it can be really hard. And the first one will be for today, still an explicit approximation, still an explicit calculation, but it's an approximation of that density. And then after we show that, we'll go through another technique, which involves just sort of having implicit knowledge of the likelihood that is sort of embedded in our model that allows us to sample according to what the distribution is, but we don't actually ever have to calculate anything about it. And so to introduce this first one, we're gonna move to a perspective of latent variable methods, which is basically saying, okay, if I have some very complex multidimensional data, there's probably some fundamental components to it which I can use to describe the majority of the data and may govern, you know, some independent criteria which realize and create the data when you mix them together. And so, yeah, we're going to be thinking in this perspective, which is if you've seen any notation floating around that's like, you know, you sample from Z and you get something from X, which you sort of did that yesterday, that sort of notation probably arises a lot more from this approach. Z is usually used as a variable to describe like hidden variables. What are the hidden components giving rise to how the data appears? So that means we can sort of write P of X as some integral over this joint distribution, which is telling us about what's the likelihood of X and its hidden representation. But that's really, if we just use some Bayes rule, a matter of saying this. Right? So we want to be able to calculate this, but of course, if we don't know anything about Z, and Z is maybe multidimensional, and then we have to marginalize that out over X, that's going to be really hard very quickly. So in general, this computation is intractable. So we've got to sort of think of a way of approaching this without explicitly calculating this, because we can't. Yeah. So you also can't invert this the other way using Bayes' rule, because we also don't have, so things that are hard for us to compute currently are P of X. Can't do this. I can't really do this either, because that would still involve computing this in sort of a Bayes rule flip. So, okay, we've got to think about this a little bit. We want to be able to, you know, take some Z from some hidden space, some simple representation, and use it to sample from some X, to get some X, right? So in a way, we're trying to come up with ways of how do I, you know, approximate P of X given Z, right? So we can say that we're going to set up this paradigm where we have a neural network with parameters theta, which is approximately going to describe, okay? And we can imagine that this is sort of I'll just leave that like that. We can imagine that this is sort of going to describe the generation process from looking at this latent space and getting some things in our data space out. So let me just think about how I want to structure this. Right, so let me just introduce some components here. We're going to try to put this in sort of an auto-encoding framework, right? Because I'll need a lot of different parts of Bayes' rule to set it up. So things I'm going to need. Okay, I need some estimate of any z given x, right? I need an approximation of p of z. And then with that, I should be able to start drawing inference based on this. So I can sort of set this up in an auto-encoding framework, okay? What I mean by that is I can have some input space for my data x, right? I can have some neural network that encodes this to some space z, right? And I can use that z then to try and reconstruct x. So in general, in this auto-encoding framework, this is a deterministic process, okay? For a given set of weights on this neural network and for a given set of weights on this neural network, I will get a specific z and get a specific x prime out, right? So that doesn't really give us a generative model. That would just be sort of a way of doing data compression. So we want to use these things, these descriptions of things, to sort of reformulate this as a sampling machine, okay? So this can actually help me now think about how I structure this, right? Because I can use this premise to sort of start bounding this, okay? I'll say that this encoding network, okay, tells me about p of z given x, right? And this decoding network tells me about p of x given z, okay? So if I have these sorts of tools, and I'll actually keep some parameters on these to just say they're not the exact things, there are approximations of them. And so I can start trying to write out then essentially ways to sort of bound this a bit. I'll move this up. So if I try to just expand my representation for what p of x is, I can say it's some expectation over sampled values. Well, actually, I want to bring this back down for a second, just to keep the notation the same as I have it in this text. If you guys look online, so this would be, these are flipped. This is phi, this is theta. Can you guys see this? Is this big enough? Okay. I can say that this representation is just sort of an expectation over my samples from Q of z given x, right? Of ln of p of x. Okay, well, if I do a little Bayes rule and I multiply by 1, I can really say that this is equal to the expectation of still over q phi z of x ln of p of x given z times p of z over theta. This should have a theta given x times just some number 1, okay, which happens to be the encoding function, okay? So this is just me saying, okay, I'll do Bayes' rule on this and then multiply by 1, okay? If I expand this out now with some log math, I can really say that this is some expectation over, you know, still coming from Q, ln of p of x given z minus still coming over Q. The ln of Q of Z given X. Phi theta of Z plus some term still over coming from Z ln of Q of Z given X over P theta of X given Z. So what I've done now is said I had this formula for P of X. I've broken it down into some Bayesian rewrite, introducing my encoding network, and I've just expanded it out with some log rules, okay? Sorry, this should be a Z, this should be an X. Okay? So I have these three terms here now, and their expectations. Well, I can actually rewrite these two as KL divergences, right? Because what I'm saying is I'm taking this expectation over Q, have this term for Q, expectation over Q, over Q, right? So what now I can say is, OK, I still have this term. Just going to bring that down, right? Now I can just say this is some KL divergence between Q of Z given X and P of theta Z, right? And this is another KL term between Q phi Z given X and P of theta Z given X. Okay? Okay. So this term, this first term, is just telling me, okay, what's the likelihood of any data given some Z, right? If I sampled some Z, I could get a likelihood measure of X. OK, well, I can exactly get an estimate of that for my reconstruction over here, right? So this term's calculable. This term here is telling me about what is the probability distance between my encoding network, which says, you know, what does Z look like for some given X, right? And what is some prior on Z, OK? How is the latent space supposed to be distributed, right? And so if I just say that I'll fix that, that P of theta is just going to be some Gaussian distribution, some multi-dimensional Gaussian distribution, OK, that allows me to have an analytic form of what P looks like, right? For this PZ, OK? So if my calculation in this encoding network gives me some analytic terms about a Gaussian, I can compare those analytic terms to the analytic terms I would have for this prior. We'll say that's calculable, OK? This last term's not calculable. So this is going to be an intractable measure. But because we've now written it as a KL divergence, we know that it's always going to be greater than 0. So what we can say is, OK, we explicitly calculate these two, and now they function as a lower bound. Right? This is always positive, right? So now I can say that this whole thing is sort of a lower bound on the log likelihood of our data. So if I maximize this, if I raise this up as high as I can, I know that my likelihood is at least that high, right? So this is sort of an approximate bounded estimation of the likelihood of our data. You're not going to be able to calculate this. You can only calculate this because currently you've made some assumption about this. And this other term is just a reconstruction term that's some binary cross entropy or mean squared error, something like that. OK. So
why is it that the KL divergence is always positive?
That's just how it's defined. So if you tried to calculate any KL divergence between things, you would see that it's always greater than 0. It's not a proper metric because it's not symmetric. So the KL divergence of Q line line P is not the same as P line line Q, right? I don't know what to call these two, of course. And it doesn't satisfy the triangle inequality. But the one thing it does do, like most metrics, is it's positive. Yeah. Oh, right. So now we have to think a little bit about how do you actually structure doing this calculation in terms of this model? OK, so we say that we have some, put it right here. We say that we want to be able to compare this prior so that we can do this calculation here, right, to what's going on in this network. OK, well, then I essentially have to rewrite this a little bit so that I can do all the optimization techniques that I usually like to do. Okay, because clearly here we have some random sampling over z. And I can't really random sample in the middle of my network, get a number, and then expect to be able to backpropagate through random number generation. There's no gradients to be passed through that, right? Because it's not really a function. I wouldn't be calculating the gradient and everything. I would just be randomly sampling and then saying I can somehow get back to the weights in this network, which I can't. So we have to rewrite this bottleneck a little bit. Because I've defined z as some analytic thing, I can actually say what my network does is, OK, it takes in some data, right? And now it maps to two little secondary layers, which one of which I'll call mu, and one of which I'll call sigma, or yeah, I'll just leave it as sigma, which we can say are parameters of some other Gaussian form, right? Maybe it's not perfectly zero identity, right? It has some covariance. It has some non-zero mean. But we're trying to train it so that it behaves and looks a little bit like this, right? So now I get to here, and I say, OK, I want to still be able to randomly sample to make some inference on what comes out of here. I randomly draw an epsilon that's not part of the graph, right? That doesn't need to be backpropagated through, which is n 0, 1. And then I sort of use this fact to construct some z, right? Which is just going to be equal to the mu plus sigma times epsilon. This term is actually a variance. And when you construct this in a network itself, you're going to choose this to be something like log sigma and then take an exponential of it just for numerical stability. But in fact, it's probably easier if I just call it what it is, right? I could be taking the square root of the variance, but it's not that necessary. In the end, the point is you have these two parameters which define your network, right? And your distribution, and you randomly sample. And then you take this, and you feed it in to get some x prime. So what are the dynamics of this whole process? On the one hand, I have this reconstruction term, which is trying to make x and x prime sort of equal each other, right? So that's basically saying this network should sort of be an inverse of this network, right? So that I can put x into z and then sort of recover x to a good approximation. But at the same time, we're also sort of forcing this space, this latent space, to have some Gaussian behavior to it, right? And these are a bit of competing optimization problems. One is supposed to help you sort of generalize your sampling. I can get, you know, expressive and diverse samples if this criteria is met well. And the other is saying, well, no, I want to be able to reconstruct any of those points to an explicit thing in the data space. I don't want them to get jumbled up, right? So what does this sort of look like in practice? So you can imagine, can you guys see my cursor up there? You imagine that I have some space X, right, which is, you know, the space my data is living in. And when I go to map it with this Q of Z given X, each of these maps for z, q of z, given some specific x, is going to try to be Gaussian. It's going to try to sit along this middle space, right, and have sort of identity covariance, right? A lot like this, the structure which I've drawn on here. But as it competes with this reconstruction term, you're going to see that that actually isn't a perfect case, right? You're going to see that they're going to take on some strange covariances. They're going to try to get to the center. It's not going to work perfect.
Oh, just one question. Does it really try to be a Gaussian? Or is it basically, if you calculate a KL divergence, you just force your the batch on which you learn on to be zero-centered with?
Right. So my question is, what would be the difference between those two things? Because what you're learning are those parameters. You're learning the parameters of the Gaussian, right? And so essentially you're learning the that the Gaussian, it fits some specific Gaussian shape, right?
So my question is, does it learn a Gaussian, or does it learn some other distribution which just has zero mean and
Well, it's learning the parameters of a Gaussian, which we then compare to a Gaussian.
Yeah.
And so what, in an ideal optimization sense, though, you could see the, if you minimize the reconstruction term, say it's not important, forget about that, that these will really force themselves to start being Gaussian distributed. I take these parameters, and then I calculate a Gaussian number with them, right? And so it's fixed sort of in this Gaussian regime, but it's going to be warped and confused sometimes because it's trying to do this other optimization process too, right? It's trying to be able to say, I have to come up with this whole complex set of weights which will reconstruct my data while also maintaining this bottleneck. And so this is a trade-off. And so what you'll see is, okay, if I have, if this KL term is not, strongly enforced, you'll start seeing that these different Gaussians with different covariances and different means will start to overlap a little bit. And what that means is some data that I had x here, when I go to reconstruct it, well, it might map really to the same point in the reconstruction space. So I'll have a few data points like this one and this one sort of mapping to the same spot after the reconstruction. And that's going to limit your ability to sort of generalize your samples. Yep.
What did the multiple of red Gaussians represent?
So that's me saying, here's some data x, yeah, right? This encoding network now tells me P of z given that x. And I want each of those P of z's given some x to look Gaussian.
Okay.
Right? That this KL term is saying, push all these things together.
Why do we want it to be Gaussian?
Because what you're trying to do is create a generative model. And that means you want all your data to be in a space which you can interpolate over, and that every z that you pull out sort of maps to something in the space, the continuous space of where your data has been embedded. Right? And so we choose a Gaussian because it allows us to explicitly calculate the probability distribution comparison to make that space have some structure. It doesn't have to be a Gaussian. People use other things. People have stuck RBMs inside as the latent space and done a whole other thing with that. There's a lot of new stuff coming out now about ways you can use approximations of a distance metric I'm about to introduce after this that lets you structure that latent space to model any sort of data that you want it to sort of be structured around. But the idea is to have some tractable thing that you can compute that allows us to say there's a probabilistic interpretation over the space of where I have embedded x into some dimensionally reduced space. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So the mu and sigma that you had on the board, really that's per x.
Yeah.
So you have some network that gives you a mu and sigma,
right,
for each x.
Over many batches, as he was saying. But yeah. Yeah. Right? Because what I'm calculating for every x is a new set of mu's and a new set of sigma's, right? And so yeah, there's this sort of push and pull competition here where, you want your data to be separable from the space, right? I want to be able to pull it all out and reconstruct it, but I also want it to be nice and continuous where one flows into the next, right? And so people do lots of work on thinking about how to structure this latent space. You can force enforce independence criteria on it so that this latent dimensionality reduction might boil down to just the independent components of the data, which you can then navigate over. You can do all sorts of stuff like that. So that's just a little description of what happens in there. still freaks me out. Right. So, some of the advantages of this. We say, okay, there's some stable training to it still, because I have that reconstruction term, which is just sort of a general maximum likelihood approach to things. We can say also that it's very easy to sample from P of X given some Z, right? I pull a random Gaussian number, which I've said this latent space has to look like. I said all my data exists in this Gaussian space. I pull a random number, and then I feed it through the decoding network, and I get X, right? So this is an easy way to have inference given some Z. That being said, I still have to do some Monte Carlo sampling. To get purely inference on X, right? I'd still have to marginalize out Z. So if your latent space becomes a little big, you're going to still hit a bottleneck of how do I properly sample over this to get a good estimate of just this likelihood versus the conditional likelihood. Yeah. And the other thing is having this MLE reconstruction term can sort of limit the resolution of the images that come out. But this is sort of put an asterisk next to this because it's definitely gotten better. All you have to do is throw more compute time at these things and they wind up working better, which is sort of weird. Okay. We feel okay about the variational approach to variational autoencoders? And now saying I'm putting some variational bound, which I try to maximize, on a normal autoencoding framework, which is usually a deterministic thing, but now I've spun it as a generative model, right? By using this little reparameterization trick, right, where this is making some mu and some sigma rather than just going straight to some z, and then I sample according to those, and I force that distribution to look like some fixed analytic distribution like a Gaussian. So that was the
Is there like some like order of magnitude heuristic of the relative size of the required latent space relative to the data set where this stops being like a
great question. There's lots of things that people have generally done to understand how many dimensions of their data are actually important for explaining it. One of the big ones was from back in the day, people still use, of course, called PCA. These principal component analysis, and you figure out something about what's really governing the covariance of your data. People have tried to make arguments to show that the latent space does something similar to that. So there's some arguments to say about, okay, how much of my data can I explain by Z, and they have some metrics to do that. You can calculate that to say, I only need such and such dimensions to this lower dimensional space to explain X. And the other reason people try to force some more control, maybe saying making all these components independent, is to sort of disentangle those factors. And it gives you a clearer picture of what is actually transforming the data. But you won't get an order of magnitude number that tells you about it that easily. If that makes sense.
Is Z the same dimension as X normally?
No. No, usually it's much smaller. It's up to you to decide. You'll see that your reconstructions get better if you make it bigger, but you're also making the optimization process over comparing it to this Gaussian prior harder. So it's always a push and pull with these types of things. Yeah. There's some cool papers though if you guys want to look up. One's called Disentangling by Factorizing, and you can show that this probability can actually be broken down into a number of terms, one of which is called the total correlation, which sort of tells you about the independence measure of this. And people use this to say, okay, if I enforce this total correlation minimization rather than just, you know, comparing these distributions exactly, if I had a bunch of images of faces, moving through the latent space would actually break it down to, you know, like rotating the head, or like going from a frown to a smile, or like having their hair grow out. So then this is sort of learning those fundamental components of what the structure of faces actually would be.
Is this just the beta VIE, or is this, do they do that in something in addition to that?
Sorry?
Is this what you're talking about, the beta VIE?
The beta VIE is just saying, I'm going to take this term, and I'm going to put some factor beta in front of it and say this term's now a little bit more important or less important than the reconstruction term. That's a little different from this disentangling by factorizing metric, which is saying, let me break this down into three terms and focus on only one of them. And that
beta hyperparameter?
Yeah, exactly. It's some number which you choose that says, OK, I'm going to stress that more than the reconstruction.
If you mess around with that term and add in a beta or something, then isn't it not a bound anymore? It's not a lower bound of P,
yes.
Right?
Hmm.
I mean, it might make sense to focus on part of the problem more than another, but you lose.
Right. Yeah. So. Right, but you'll see that people don't really use it for too much inference measure. They just use it as a sampling machine, right? And that you go under the principle of maximum likelihood estimation to do that. But when they wiggle or break it a little bit, I don't think they're too worried about this exact metric because they're never calculating that exact metric, right? It's sort of just like, I'm gonna try to approach maximum likelihood estimation as a principle of optimization rather than as a measure. So they don't care too much about this, rather sort of just the scaling.
Sorry, I might be completely wrong here, but
last question.
The first term is a log likelihood type thing, so it means it's negative because a log of a number between 0 and 1 is negative.
Mm-hmm.
So if we multiply, this should still be an upper bound, I think. That doesn't matter, I just forgot I said anything.
No, I think you're right. Because yeah. The KO divergence is positive.
Exactly.
So since it's a lower bound, you can multiply it by an arbitrary large positive number, and you can still be able to
That's what I was thinking, yes. Yeah. So I think that still works out somehow, but people just don't stress it in their analyses, I guess.
Yeah, not too much.
A
lot of the way you actually would go about optimizing this, that's why I was thinking about saying, okay, well, this is actually a log of sigma, and then you exponentiate, is because in practice, people do things for numerical stability, or, you know, okay, what you actually go to approach in the minimization here is maybe a negative log likelihood, but this is the bound which tells you about the optimization. Okay, I'm gonna move on just so we can start talking about the last one. So last thing is implicit generative models, right? And the one we're gonna talk about is just called generative adversarial network, okay? So now we want to work with a GAN. So generally, people have been using this whole maximum likelihood estimation thing as a way of having some controlled and principled metric over their optimization process. Sometimes, though, it's not very easy to just use this number, or there are some setbacks, I would say, to just using this sort of this number as a way of scaling up. And we could say that. Well, we have all these neural network techniques, which are highly expressive functions, which tell us, you know, about very complex ways to represent data. What if I said my likelihood metric was sort of hidden in the optimization of a neural network, right? And now I've highly parameterized this likelihood so that, you know, it's sort of a more flexible metric of thinking about my data. And so that's sort of the principle behind generative adversarial networks, which is saying, I still want to have some understanding of P of X, but I'm going to do that now just through being able to sample it, right? I want to be able to draw samples from it. Okay, so what's the premise behind this? Imagine that I just always want to make sure my notation follows what I put in this. Yeah. Imagine that I had two neural networks. I'll call G, which has parameters theta, and D, which has parameters phi. Okay? These are two neural networks. And I'm going to use them to sort of gain inference on some approximation. P of x given z, OK? Just saying, OK, this, you'll see why I call this g, and you'll see why these have the same sort of parametric theta on them in a second. I want to say that this g is actually some generator network, OK? It's going to take in some random Gaussian number z. See, I'm sticking with my z notation from before. It's inspired by latent variable techniques. But z is just purely a random number. I'm not saying it explains any of the data, OK? So I draw this random z, 0i, right? And I feed that into some neural network, which is going to give me some x, OK? And so this is g, right? And with this, you know, I also have a bunch of training data. So I'll stick the coin. No, I'll leave it as x, right? I have some set of training data with this x, which I can use as a comparison metric. Usually I do that in some maximum likelihood estimation technique. I'm going to say now that I have some other network, okay, and this will be d, which takes either the output from the generator. I'm going to call it x prime now just to differentiate. Or it samples from the real data. So to go back and forth with this. And it's going to give me a measure of the probability that that data is real. OK? Right? So this is sort of the optimizations that I set up we have now, right? And what this does is it allows me to tie how well this network can tell things apart to the optimization of how well this network can produce, you know, good-looking data, things that seem convincing. And so how do I go about writing this down as an optimization process? Well, I have to sort of keep these two things together. It's sounding like sort of a mini-max game where these two networks are competing or adversaries of each other. I like to think of them more as collaborators, because there's not one's not necessarily trying to beat out the other, just learns from the other one, right? So we set up this cost, which is essentially, well, I write it like this, a mini max, where the generator is trying to minimize, and the discriminator is trying to maximize this function, which is just telling me about x from, I'm going to label this as p real. Okay. I might abbreviate that to pr at some point if I get lazy. Over the log of what the discriminator is telling me about data that is real. So it obviously wants to maximize this term. It wants to say all the real data is real. Plus some other competing term where I sample from z, right? That's saying, here's a situation where the generator is trying to minimize this term, right? It really wants to convince the discriminator that it's produced a real thing. OK, that would send this down to minus infinity, right? And there's this sort of push and pull game going on here, right?
Where is z sample?
Z is me saying, there's the random number that I sample, which goes into the generator and gives me something in the space of the data, which hopefully that the discriminator at some point can't tell the difference between that thing the generator created and what the real data looks like. But I have to sample from some random space, some Gaussian space, to, you know, produce these things. But the notation's the same, but I'm not saying it has like some like reconstruction or fundamental qualities of the of this, you know, dimensionality reduction latent variable technique. People have tried to incorporate those things, but the original GAN formulation didn't try to suggest that. It just needed a random number. Okay, so can everyone see this? Oop, that's not what I wanted. This equation, right? You see how this is a mini-max game. They're both trying to compete against each other. Now, a way to... Right. A way to sort of approach this in understanding what the behavior of this optimization criteria is to sort of try to look at what happens when we have an optimal discriminator. Discriminator is as good as it possibly can be, right? So what we can do is sort of look at this value function as an integral, right? Instead of saying we have approximations, I'll say that v of dg equals, you know, some integration over x for p real. That's log d dx plus over z of pz of z times the log of 1 minus d of g of z dz, which is really, I can just also, you know, tuck this under one integral if I assume that the things that this creates, Jenner creates, are actually in the same space, x. Just now saying p real, you know, log d plus pg, the generator's distribution looks like, of log 1 minus d of x. Me just condensing everything to get rid of the z notation, which I think is a bit distracting. So, okay. There's a quick proof to be shown that I don't have enough time to say, okay, if I choose an optimal discriminator, that based off this formula, but the discriminator that would maximize this, right, because it's still trying to do this maximization process, I'll call this d star with my parameters phi, is going to be equal to p real x over p real x plus pg of x. Okay. So with that, I can rewrite this value function now, which tells me that, okay, with v star is now actually just a minimization process for g over v d star g. It's just going to really look like that expectation over x of log d star of x plus expectation of x sampled from PG, log 1 minus what d star of x. Okay, sorry, that sort of took off on a diagonal. But okay, we just said what d star should look like in each of these cases. So now I can rewrite what this is a little bit. Can you guys still see over here? Or is this thing starting to get in the way? It's good? Okay. Now I can say that this is sort of, say it over here, right? An expectation of x over the log of p real plus pg, plus expectation of x coming from pg now. Of again, now PG over P real plus PG, because we have a 1 minus term here. Okay, so when these two distributions actually do wind up equaling each other, i.e. P, the generator's distribution and the discriminator's, and the real data's distribution are equal, then this term is really just gonna be 1 half, right? 1 half, and that tells me that, okay, D star is equal to 1 half, which says that this whole thing is actually just equal to negative log 4. So the lowest possible value of the cost function for optimal discriminator is negative log 4. Okay. So that's what we're driving to this whole time. If I take this number, and I go back to this step, and I say, okay, well, if that's the real minimization right there, right? I can say, what am I actually trying to do this minimization over, right? So now I can say, B star is really, I'm just pulling out the minus log 4 from this other equation. It's just saying, B star is minus log 4 plus, again, these expectation terms, which are now slightly different. Log of P real over P real plus PG, right, over 2, because I need to pull out, to divide by 2 to get this number over here, plus expectation of X coming from the generator of log PG over P real plus PG over 2. Okay, well now actually what I've ended up with are 2 KL divergence terms again. And these KL divergence terms in their sum, written as they are in this sort of symmetric form, are actually now just equal to this thing called the Jensen-Shannon divergence, okay? Between P real and PG, okay? And so what we're actually doing this whole time is this minimization process over this Jensen-Shannon divergence. We didn't realize we were doing that based off of this immediate description. But the Jensen-Shannon divergence doesn't have that many great properties to do minimization over. So if you've heard of, you've seen, I don't know, have you guys heard of generative adversarial networks before? You've never seen some of the cool pictures that they can make. They originally had all these stability problems where this optimization was sort of a pain in the butt. And at times, it would collapse to specific modes of the data. You'd get really good at making, if you had a whole set of, furniture, you might really make images of chairs really well, but you seemingly only make images of chairs because this generator has sort of collapsed on one mode of the data, and it's found a way to sort of not be able to be updated properly. And it comes down a lot of times to this fact that this Jensen-Shannon divergence doesn't always give informative gradients. So,
sorry, Michael?
Yeah.
So when you say we're taking the optimal discriminator, mm-hmm. does this mean we're taking a discriminator who's always able to tell which point belongs to the data and which point belongs to the noise?
Right. So
taking the discriminator, which is just 1/2, is just completely confused. Some sort of intuitive endpoint of the training process of a GAN.
Right. So this is the assumption that we're taking, right? Is that, yeah. At any time, that this ratio, this is all I want to say about what the optimal discriminator is that this ratio of its probability estimates would be this.
I can't really see what...
P real over P real plus PG, okay?
Yeah.
That's all I'm defined. For such a random X, that's what the optimal discriminator would give us. It's a mathematical trick here to just sort of say in this optimal case, right, where these, we have this sort of balanced ratio, right? Let's think about what happens to what the optimization process really is. And there's a quick little drawing in the notes online, which are basically to show that when these distributions are not really near each other, when PG and P real are very different, this Jensen-Shannon divergence saturates and sort of just becomes really flat. And you're not getting any informative gradients from it about how the generator should learn. So the generator is just sort of going to get stuck. I don't really have too much time to draw it out, so just look online in the notes. But OK, what have people done to sort of fix this problem? I'm afraid of getting it stuck.
Somehow this side never gets stuck.
Never gets stuck?
Not for me. I don't know if you guys are making it.
So there are two ways people have tried to reformulate this problem, right? I don't want to say that this was bad. It's very good. It makes really cool, beautiful images, right? Sometimes. Other times it doesn't converge at all because it doesn't have stable training. But people have thought about this problem and say, okay, what's this optimization really like? They've made sort of two, I think, very useful investigations of how to improve this model. And one is to sort of introduce this other form of the GAN called the Wasserstein GAN. Okay? And in this case, we're going to try to spin the whole thing into a question of optimal transport. If I have two piles of mass, what is the optimal path or process for me moving some of that mass such that they overlap, right? I want to make these two things look the same. How do I transport that material, or in this case, that probability density, in the most efficient way possible to have a metric of comparison between these distributions, right? And that's sort of spinning the whole thing as what's called optimal transport. And there are a bunch of distance metrics people have come up with over the years to sort of hash out all the theory behind that. And what we're going to use here is sort of this thing called the Wasserstein distance, okay? Which is a measure between data that just is basically telling you how much of one model's mass needs to be moved to make these things equal, right? And it's also called the Earth mover distance, because it's sort of like moving the mass somewhere else. So we can write it down in terms of the Wasserstein between some P real and some PG. It's basically saying, in general, and it's non-approximate form, that this is some infimum over all possible gamma, which come from the set of joint distributions whose marginals are PR and PG, okay? Such that the expectation of over x and y sampled from the joint, this is just equal to x minus y, okay? Just a pretty generic comparison of values there. So you can, yeah. These would be samples coming from PR, PG, right? The problem is, okay, how do you find the infimum over all possible products of this? This is a really complex problem very quickly, right? So this is essentially what we're saying is we're looking for the greatest lower bound for any transport plan, right? I'm looking for the one which maximizes this distance in terms of, but still is looking for the minimum process across that maximum distance, just to be sure that you've covered, you know, all possible distance metrics between these two sets of piles of mass, right? So we need to come up with some approximation for this, and thankfully, there's this thing called the Kantorovich-Rubinstein duality, which we don't have too much time to say, but we could say, under the assumption, well, I'll just write it down first, that we can say this Wasserstein distance, PRG, is really now some supremum over all functions f who have a Lipschitz norm less than 1, and we look for the comparison expectation PR of f of x minus x coming from PG of f of x. So now, what is a Lipschitz norm? Lipschitz norm is just basically saying, is the gradients basically, they always have to be less than or equal to 1, right? The gradients of this function f. It's just telling me that the slope is smooth and sort of converged up to some norm value. So this would be what's called the 1 Lipschitz. This is just a requirement for this Kantorovich-Rubinstein duality to be maintained, okay? And now what we're saying is, okay, we're looking for this function f, which tells us about this supremum. Right? And so how can we do that? Well, before we had some discriminator which told us about the probability of our data being real or fake. Now I'm going to say the discriminator is not something giving me a probability estimate. It's saying it's learning this function f, which is telling, it's sort of now a general critic, which is telling me about the distance between these piles of mass. And now the optimization process is convincing the discriminator that the piles of mass are equal, right? Because it's also supposed to be, you know, this supremal function, which is telling me about this distance, right? So that was the way this had sort of been respun. The problem is it's very hard to maintain this Lipschitz constraint. And so people have come up with some hacks to do this. one of which is sort of just to penalize the gradients themselves. To say, okay, I said these gradients have to be pretty small. You can take this thing and just sort of add on a term here. For x hat from some new distribution, which I'm calling px hat, which is just gradient x of f of x hat squared minus 1. Okay, so we take this norm of the gradients of x when it sees this x hat data. And this x hat data is just literally a linear combination for a random number. This is just for t samples from 0, 1. Just saying, okay, no matter the data that I look at, I just want to make sure that the gradients of this function aren't too big. And there's an equivalent thing you can do with the original GAN formulation. I'm going to sneeze. Which also helps to fix this training process, basically getting you stuck out of points where there are no gradients to backpropagate. And I just want to show you very quickly some photos of how good this thing can be. It's sort of terrifying. Is this? This person does not exist. There it is. So these are all fake people that again has figured out how to generate. Okay. You can see there's sometimes some problems with it. Okay, like he has this random piece of ear up there. She has hairs growing out of her face over here, and there's always some issues, but it's sort of terrifying how well it can learn the space of human faces, right? Where is the website? They have you play a game if you want to try to compete. It's terrifying. This one, okay, you can tell is pretty much fake, but that one's very hard to tell. That person is not real. So you can now sort of imagine the expressive power of these techniques. The problem with the GAN overall, though, is it doesn't give me any measure of my probability of the sample, right? And so if you wanted to use them for some machine learning question in physics and you wanted to know about the probability of your data, it's not really going to tell you that probability. It's just going to make a sample from the data. So people have, you know, been thinking pretty actively about how to put some likelihood spin on what the GAN is doing, but I haven't seen anything very convincing yet. But yeah, that's the set of generative models. Any questions on the last one? I tried to go through very quickly because I sort of ran out of time.
You guys, let's thank Michael.